Good evening and behind the news for February 15, 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, or many weeks at this time, it seems now, at the worlds of economics and politics. And see if I remember how to do this. It's been, more than a month, I think, since I've been here, with a regular show, that is. We've got a couple of guests up tonight. First, in a little bit, we'll be speaking with Eric Kleinenberg, who is the author of a book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, just published by Metropolitan Books. And then at the bottom of the hour, we will be joined by Steve Duncombe, who is the author of Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy. So we're dealing with the realm of consciousness tonight more than, the intersection of money and consciousness, I guess. And speaking of money and consciousness, thanks to all of those of you who pledged during the fundraiser, which was successful and very pleased to report. Thanks to those of you who pledged during this time slot and every other time slot as well. And now if you did ask us to bill you, please do send in your check. And of course, it's never too late to pledge on the web. You can always visit WBAI.org and send us some money that way. You can do that 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in your underwear if you like. And before we get to Eric Kleinenberg, just a couple of words about what's happening with the U.S. economy right now. The big conundrum is it slowing down or not? The initial read on growth in the fourth quarter of last year was 3.5%, but it's now looking that that was a little optimistic. That is going to be revised down. Looks like growth at the beginning of this year is also kind of slow, but there's some suspicion that it may accelerate as the year goes on, but maybe not. But if the economy is slowing down, then Wall Street and the Federal Reserve will be able to reduce some of their anxiety about inflation. But we should be clear on what that means, that slowing growth means unemployment will drift higher, and that would reduce pressure for wage increases that would come from tight labor markets. So when they talk about a slowing economy, they mean job losses, and that is considered a reassuring thing to those at the top of the society. But if the economy is not slowing down, then the reverse is true. Anxiety about inflation will rise, the Fed will tighten, and then the economy will eventually slow down. As I've said here several times, this is probably about as good as going to get for the average worker in this expansion. And it hasn't been very good to the average worker, this expansion. It has, however, been very, very good for corporate profits and upper bracket incomes. One reason for this uncertainty about the state of the economy is the state of the housing market and its effect on the broader economy. There are some signs, which Wall Street optimists have been quick to seize on, that things are stabilizing in the world of housing. It's commonly now said that the worst is behind us. I'm not sure I get the logic of this, because if everyone is rooting for a slowdown so the Fed doesn't raise interest rates and really bring down the hammer, then a stabilizing or reaccelerating housing market is the opposite of what they should want. In any case, after the most manic housing boom in history, it's hard to believe that the bust would be over so quickly and with so little damage. The risks that still lurk within the housing market are several. First of all, we may only be beginning to see some of the financial damage. Lots of people took out mortgages at adjustable rates, often with the first couple of years' payments set so low that they didn't even cover the interest due, with the unpaid balance then getting tacked onto the principal. These adjustable rate loans are now beginning to adjust upwards, and something like $1 trillion worth due to adjust upwards this year. And it's coming as a shock to quite a lot of people by how much it's adjusting upwards. Many people assumed that house prices would keep rising so they could refinance or sell their house at a profit, but with house prices flat or down now, they can't do that. There's a story of a woman in the Midwest in the Wall Street Journal last week who was stuck in a situation like this. She couldn't refinance because the mortgage was larger than the value of her house. So now she's taking out a $13,000 car loan to pay off her mortgage. We really don't know how many people there are like this or how it will all play out. There could be lots of defaults, or maybe not. Maybe lenders will cut sharply back on extending new loans, which could really tank the economy, or maybe that won't happen. Rising house prices also encouraged consumer spending, and with that stimulus gone, will mass consumption become less mass as the year progresses? We've also seen a little employment effect from the housing bust. Just a small fraction of the construction jobs that were added since the boom took off have been lost. Many more could come, and also in related industries as well, like building material stores and lumber producers and real estate offices and a whole lot of other things that are housing related. Something like a quarter to a half of the growth in employment over the last 5 years or so has been housing related. So if that unwinds, the damage in the labor market could be rather severe. So we shall see. Stay tuned. Let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with Eric Kleinenberg. And that a bit from the 1980 song, I Want to Destroy You by the Soft Boys, led by Robin Hitchcock, a pox upon the media and everything you read. I don't know, is that your feeling, Eric Klinenberg?
Well, I think it's a day for us to try to revive the media. That's what I'm feeling these
days. All right, let's be optimistic. Eric Klinenberg is an associate professor of sociology at NYU and author of the new book, Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, which is just published by Metropolitan Books. I noticed nothing about Pacifica in the book. I'm feeling a little slighted. What happened to us?
Well, it's a book that starts with, I think, the horror stories that people from Pacifica want to distance themselves from very much. The book does have a lot to say about indie media, however, especially new kinds of indie media. But it's really an attempt to say this debate we've had in this country about media consolidation over the last 10 years has been pretty abstract. We talk about it through numbers, or we see these big charts in magazines that show five or six companies that own so much of the field. But what we're deprived, really, by commercial media, by mainstream media, are the human stories that bring these issues to life. And so by telling the story of Clear Channel in radio, or the Sinclair Broadcast Group in television, the Tribune Company in the newspaper business, even the Village Voice Media and Alt Weeklies, I'm trying to bring this issue to life.
All right, well, let's talk about Clear Channel, since they are wearing horns and have a scent of sulfur about them. So tell us, where'd they come from?
Well, it's an interesting company. They started in San Antonio, Texas, the Mays family, which began it as really a kind of mom-and-pop operation. And, you know, U.S. law used to require radio companies to be fundamentally mom-and-pop operations for the most part, because it was illegal for any company to own more than one AM and one FM station in the same market 25 years ago. Starting with the Reagan administration, we started to deregulate, which essentially means raising the ownership caps in different markets. And in 1996, we changed the laws really dramatically, changing the local ownership cap to 8 stations in radio and eliminating the national cap altogether. And at that time, between 1996 and 1998, 40% of America's commercial radio stations changed hands, and essentially 4 or 5 giant corporations emerged, with Clear Channel being by far the biggest and most ambitious. It grew to more than 1,200 stations.
And we should underscore that date, 1996, that's when Bill Clinton was president. So there's a tendency to blame the Republicans for this, but Democrats have participated as well.
We have both parties to thank for the great media system we have in this country right now. The Republicans in Congress, that was the first term of Newt Gingrich in the Contract with America, and that was not an easy time for Bill Clinton to pass the kinds of laws he wanted. But the Republicans basically drafted it. Clinton and Gore signed it. They were really pushing this information superhighway. And the truth is that the radio issue was a kind of afterthought for everybody involved, but the National Association of Broadcasters and the lobbyist groups that were pushing for such a long time to change the media ownership laws managed to get it in. And one big story I tell in Fighting for Air is the extent to which the Federal Communications Commission and Congress have been captured by the media industry that they're really supposed to be regulating. And we should say about Clear Channel, because I think it's a story that Americans need to know, this is a company that didn't just own 1,200 radio stations. They also own the largest syndicator service for radio stations, Premier Radio Networks. They own the Rush Limbaugh Show, Dr. Laura, Michael Savage, dozens of shows. In fact, more than half of commercial radio stations in this country, all of them, use Clear Channel programming. Clear Channel also owns a big advertising group, the Katz Media Services, which sells packaged advertising to groups. They have Clear Channel Outdoor, which is responsible for the billboards you see all over town. And until recently, they own more live concert venues than any other company. They basically just spun it off. They now call it Live Nation, and the Mays family is on the board of directors, so it's not clear how independent it is. But this is a company that really has its grip on this industry, and musicians, as we know from many stories like the Dixie Chicks, which a lot of people are talking about now, are really living in fear about the consequences.
How'd they go from that mom and pop to this behemoth level?
Well, this is a very important story about the technology and money coming together. You know, we oftentimes talk about digital technologies as if they're necessarily going to liberate us from the old shackles of old media, but the truth in this case is the business efficiencies in owning 1,200 stations come from laying off the DJs, getting rid of the news departments, making sure you have offices consolidated so you don't have to pay for back office staff, and you replace as much of the live human labor as you possibly can with automated systems. And Clear Channel acquired a company called Profit that made digital voice tracking technology, and that's computer equipment basically that allows a single employee to create a 4-hour airtime program in about 20 minutes, and they can do it from any studio anywhere in the world so long as there's a network connection and the right software. And that means instead of hiring one person to do a four-hour show and all the preparation before and after, you could have one person do 7, 8, 9, 10 shows in a single day.
And they're not paid accordingly, right?
No, and this is a big issue, for the company that thousands of radio employees lost their jobs and others saw their position become so insecure that it became very difficult for them to fight for decent wages. But one thing that's important in this story is that Clear Channel recognized that Americans demand local content to some extent. We want to hear local voices. We want to know the local stories where we live. This sells very well in the marketplace. But they weren't there, and so what they did instead is they started faking local broadcasts. So, they would train their national talent to learn to pronounce the names of different towns, and they would talk as if they were spending time in cities where, in fact, they had never been. I witnessed something very similar in the television industry. This company, Sinclair Broadcast Group, which we know about from the 2004 election, they're the ones that said they were going to air the Stolen Honor documentary about John Kerry right before the election and that refused to allow their ABC affiliates from airing the Ted Koppel Nightline special where he read the names of all the U.S. war casualties in Iraq. In the television business, they're famous because they own more local affiliates than any other company, and they were central casting from a studio in suburban Baltimore. And I got in there. I did a profile of Sinclair for Rolling Stone, and I saw these five weather studios where they have meteorologists doing reports for four or five different cities per afternoon. They had robotically controlled cameras, which they could use with a joystick on their own, and they would just file these reports on the air as if they were in towns, again, that they actually were not in.
That sounds terrible, but on the other hand, weather is often quite dumb in local broadcasting. So what have we lost by that arrangement?
Well, what you can lose is the possibility for getting really localized information in the event that something goes wrong. So if there's a storm system coming into town, for example, that can be a real problem if the meteorologist doesn't actually know the local areas. But another thing that I think it just fundamentally turned a lot of people off of these broadcasts is the broadcast medium, it's a medium that works because the airwaves are a public resource, unlike any other kind of business. For the most part, they're working through public property, which we allocate to broadcast corporations in exchange for certain public service and public interest obligations. And I think a lot of Americans began to feel like their media was becoming degraded when they would hear an announcer mispronounce the name of their town, for example, or say something that just seemed to be ludicrously out of touch with the place where they operated. And the big story in Fighting for Air is about the severing of this relationship between media companies and the communities that they serve. And this is true for newspapers. It's true for radio stations commercially. It's true for television stations as well. And I think it's gotten us into the situation where a lot of Americans are so fed up with the media system they have today that they're demanding something better.
I want to get back to this point, but back to Clear Channel for a moment. The buyout firm Fix News had something to do with their rise, didn't they?
Sure. They were funded with Clear Channel acquired a number of radio stations, hundreds of radio stations that had been purchased by Hicks Muse. And the relationship between the Mays family and the Hicks family goes back quite a ways. The Hicks family, just for those of you not following the intricacies of the Bush administration, these are the ones who purchased the Texas Rangers from the president, giving him a profit estimated of somewhere between $12 million and $18 million, and so this is a big Texas story.
And they were one of his early backers, and
absolutely.
Certainly crucial to his rise to national
prominence.
Absolutely,
and a lot of people who are critical of Clear Channel are very concerned about the very explicit political agenda that the corporate executives have.
Tell us about that.
Well, this is a company that clearly gives far more money to Republican candidates than to Democratic candidates, and that most big companies try to hedge their bets because you never know who's going to win the next election. But Clear Channel, Sinclair, they don't care about these kinds of things. But actually now they've taken their political agenda into the broadcast booth, and they've clearly taken it into their outdoor advertising. People in New York might remember the situation in the 2004 Republican convention. A group called Project Billboard wanted to do an anti-war advertisement in Times Square at the Marriott Hotel. And Clear Channel, which owns that space, initially said, yeah, you can run an ad here. But when they saw the content, they rejected it. And they literally would not allow them to run an anti-war ad. At the same time, it should be said, the Clear Channel was running these kinds of patriotic, pro-war ads around the country. They also, it needs to be said, either fired or moved into the early morning hours a number of DJs, Clear Channel personalities, who started to speak out against the war on their broadcasts, and where there was a lawsuit against them, very controversial stuff. Again, at the same time that they supported one of their extreme right-wing DJs who was doing these rallies for America at cities across the country. And then probably everyone has heard about the songs that were banned from Clear Channel stations right after September 11th, songs like Imagine and various other kinds of peace tunes. And so this is a company that's really tried to use its control of the broadcast spectrum to shape American politics.
We're speaking with Eric Klein, who is a professor of sociology at NYU and author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, just published by Metropolitan Books, which I believe is owned by a German conglomerate, isn't it? Let's return to this issue of local ownership, because I remember when I lived in Virginia in the 1970s, I came across a lot of locally owned newspapers that were real crap.
Yeah.
And you quote something from Upton Sinclair's Brass Check about
That's right.
the dim-wittedness of your average local newspaper proprietor. So sometimes I get the feeling that we're nostalgic for a time that really isn't worth being nostalgic about, that these small-town, locally-owned papers were really intimate parts of the local power structure. The papers I'm recalling in Virginia published a lot of stupid, just National Wire Service stories. They couldn't paste the headlines on straight. And for people now to be able to get the New York Times in these kinds of areas, this kind of nationalization of the media is a good thing for them. They're getting a better newspaper now.
Yeah.
So how nostalgic should we really be for this local ownership day?
Well, I'm against nostalgia, but I'm for the idea of companies that are invested in their local communities in some way. I mean, we live in a digital age now, and it's just a fact and a wonderful fact that we can get access to information from all over the world, including really high-quality national and international reporting, although it needs to be said that media consolidation has affected the big national papers as well, and we're seeing a contraction of bureaus, for example, with far fewer people actually doing reporting on the streets of Iraq than we really need to see. So we could use more perspective, but we have access to the New York Times and to other national publications. But when I travel across the country, what I heard from everyone on the left and the right and basically everyone in between, that they felt that their newspapers no longer really reflected the local voices. They couldn't see local issues reported very well. They recognized that lots of beats that used to be there were no longer around. They were getting lots of wire copy. They longed for a news product that felt homemade, and they were really concerned about this kind of homogenization in reporting and also in culture on the airwaves. So I don't think we should be nostalgic. I go to great length in the book to show the horror stories of really bad local coverage. But I think we do need to have some kind of system in place for getting companies to be invested in the places where they operate. And what we're seeing now is that the big chain companies have clearly demonstrated they're not interested in investing in quality local journalism. Big media does not mean big journalism. It means smaller journalistic staffs.
Pierre Bourdieu had a little book on TV that the New Press published about 10 years ago, which I liked very much. But one of the arguments he makes in there is that it's not really a matter so much of ownership, but about he's focusing mainly on news and public affairs programming. But the competition that for profit maximization and audience maximization is what dumbs the content down, and that competition leads not to diversity but a depressing sameness. What's the real causative mechanism here? Is it the concentrations, or is it that there's less and less insulation against the demands of profit maximization in the media business?
Yeah, well, Bourdieu was concerned about ownership as well, and very concerned about what it meant that the French media system was becoming so much more corporate and that there was so much less support for public or independent media. And so that's one thing we should be clear about with him. My big complaint in this book is that the regulatory changes in the United States over the last 10 years have actually decreased the amount of competition in local markets. You know, there are far fewer newspapers in the United States than there used to be, far less competition in newspaper markets. The overwhelming majority of American cities have just one newspaper, and so when they fire dozens or hundreds of reporters, people don't have an alternative. Clearly, there's less competition in the radio market. There's a real shortage, I think, of pressure to go out and do the original reporting or the deep digging or the original fresh programming that's going to draw people in. And I think that's one reason why Americans are looking for alternative sources of media, going online, going to public radio, which has been a huge beneficiary of commercialization in the last 10 years. So actually, I think one problem we have with the media market is that they're less competitive, and that's a reason that even people like William Safire are upset about consolidation today. Again, unless you own a big media company or a ton of shares in them, it's very hard to identify your personal interest in a media system that allows big companies to get even bigger. And yet, what I show in the book is that this is exactly what Congress and the FCC have been doing over the last 10 years. The second half of the book tells the story of why so many Americans have found ways to protest. It's the story of the media reform movement, which is actually winning some incredible victories.
All right. Since in these things I usually like wait for the last 2 minutes to ask the what is to be done question, let's like quadruple that usual amount of time. All right. What is happening? How can we make things better?
Well, there's a big fight going on this year, and you need to know about it, and you're not going to hear about it from network news. You're not going to read about it on the front page of the paper, no matter what newspaper you read.
But you will hear about it here on listener-sponsored radio.
That's right, and that's why we need resources like this. So here now we can talk about Pacifica and what it provides. The first thing to know is that in Congress right now, over the next year or two, we will see a huge fight over the future of the internet. And this is this issue you might hear as net neutrality or equal access online. And one big issue now is the telephone and cable companies, which control our access to broadband and to the internet for most of us anyway. They want to change the way that the internet works. They essentially want to be able to create a tiered pricing structure so that deep-pocketed corporate clients can pay them really large amounts of money to make sure that their websites reach us at home faster than everyone else's. They would put the kind of independently produced sites, blogs, video blogs into the slow lane, and you would get newscorporation.com faster than ever. Now, this has tremendous significance in a media that's going to become increasingly digital. In the next several years, we'll get television, movies, internet, but also even telephone service online. And so this debate about the future of broadband is incredibly significant. And what needs to be said is there is no single public interest benefit from allowing a tiered price structure. It could really cripple competition, but also this kind of entrepreneurial zeal that's allowed so many new voices to get attention online. So when you hear about
net
neutrality.
The chair of the FCC has made it pretty clear he's no fan of net neutrality, right?
No, but it's actually in Congress's hands. This is a congressional issue. And last year, it took 1.5 million Americans joining the SaveTheInternet.com coalition in 3 weeks and writing letters to Congress to do something about this. So the debate's going to be in Congress. There's going to be a push from the White House, and there's actually going to be some sentiment from the Democrats that maybe this is something we should support. And it needs to be said, although Americans are overwhelmingly united on this issue, congressional officials and FCC people, they have a very hard time opposing the interests of big media companies because they know how powerful they can be in determining the future of their own careers. This is a very big issue. And I just heard Ed Markey say that the communications companies have a single lobbyist assigned to every single member of Congress, the Center for Public Integrity in Washington.
Amazing.
It is amazing, and we don't know that. And the Center for Public Integrity just produced a report showing $500 million in political contributions from media companies in the last 10 years. That's not even lobbying. So it is very...
Well, and also I can imagine that politicians wouldn't want to alienate the owners of media since that's their lifeblood.
Right? No, that's exactly right, and that's especially true when you think about everyone who's accountable to local voters and local elections. And local broadcasters, television stations, radio stations, they can determine how much attention you get in the media. They can determine when your ads are placed at what time, if you're buying the discounted ads that political candidates tend to. So political officials of both parties, they're very reluctant to oppose the big communications companies. So there's net neutrality, and you should really tune into that. There is also right now at the FCC a proceeding on media ownership, and the FCC is now looking to expand the ownership caps for radio companies even more. They're saying, you know, we're going to raise the local caps from 8 to maybe 10 or 12 stations, and the National Association of Broadcasters again and Clear Channel again is pushing very hard for this change.
Clear Channel has stumbled in recent years, hasn't it? It's not doing quite as well as
well, the stock value has fallen, and actually you might have heard that the Clear Channel just announced they were going to sell the company for $18 billion plus $8 billion of debt relief. But it's a very interesting thing that's happening right now, which is that the large organized shareholders are saying, wait a minute, when we look closely at this deal, it seems to us as if that this is going to be a boondoggle for the Mays family and for the senior executives, and actually the shareholders are getting a very bad deal out of this. And so it's not at all clear that the shareholders are going to allow this proposed deal to go through. And one thing that happened is Clear Channel realized that doing quality radio was going to take investing in all these local markets that they didn't want to invest in. They've changed their practices in the last couple of years and started to spend
Have they lost listeners because they've got such a crappy product?
Oh, yeah, they're hemorrhaging people off the dial. And you know, I teach college students, and I ask them all the time, you know, how many of you used to listen to music radio? And everybody raises their hand. And then, you know, how many of you listen to now? Almost no one raises their hand. And they say, part of the reason is the iPod. We love our MP3s. We love the internet. But part of the reason, they said, is we got sick of listening to 20 minutes of commercials for every hour of airtime. We got sick of hearing the same songs over and over again. We got sick of a radio dial that sounded the same no matter what city we went into. And so
it does seem that commercial radio is worse than TV even. It's really just remarkable.
Well, I think it is. And that's because the market was so uncompetitive. When you had a company like Clear Channel that could have eight stations and eight of the major stations in the big cities, they really dulled down the dial. They got cocky. You know, the other thing that needs to be said is they established a system where you got the same big brand name radio stations everywhere you go. And think about how this has transformed your experience going to different parts of the United States. And one thing I want to emphasize here is that we have really a great tradition of truly local media in this country, distinctive, even cacophonous voices throughout our history, whether it's newspapers or radio. And in the last 10 years, I think we've really seen a dramatic loss in the vitality of our local media markets. And you can hear that. You know, you go to Philadelphia or Chicago or San Francisco and turn on the radio, it's going to sound a lot like the commercial music you listen to here. It's you're not going to hear the sounds of those cities. So at the FCC right now, there is a big push to expand the ownership limits. There's even a push to allow newspaper companies to own TV stations, radio stations, like they haven't been able to do in 30 years. But the good news is that there are millions of Americans who've said, enough of this. You know, we are tired of this wave of deregulation. We want a more responsible, accountable media system. Go to freepress.net if you're interested in learning about it, or go to the NYC Grassroots Media Conference, which is on February 24th at the New School. It's a great local event, a grassroots media convention for people in New York City who care about this issue. February 24th at the New School. There are just millions of people around the country doing this kind of work. You don't hear about them, but they're doing a great job.
I've only got about 30 seconds left, but just what about public broadcasting, which has gotten narcotic and conservative and commercialized? Any hope for turning that around?
Well, you know, there's variation from local market to local market. NPR suffers from a lot of the problems that we've discussed here, that they have these kind of signature national programs that have become so popular. And a lot of local stations can't afford to do their own independent programming, and so they just rely on the national stuff. When you hear the pledge drives from NPR stations, you know, they actually do need your resources too, because the programming for local news, for live talent, does cost money. And so, you know, we need a more robust national public radio system. We clearly need to keep on supporting Pacifica and our local Pacifica affiliates. I mean, this is a vital resource in a very commercialized, consolidated market.
All right, that's it. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us, Eric Kleinenberg, who is a professor of sociology at NYU and author of Fighting for Air, The Battle to Control America's Media, just published by Metropolitan Books. And again, that New School Conference, New York City Grassroots Media, February 24th at the New School. And let's take a break for station ID and then a little musical break, and we'll be back with Steve Duncombe.
Yo, this is Michael Franti from Spearhead saying, whoop, whoop, we come and never pre-recorded, live and direct, it's just listener-supported on WBAI. Peace.
Cosmic Debris, Sunday mornings, 5 to 6 a.m. Music, sound, spoken word, the bird of the week, sonic surprises. Cosmic Debris, 5 a.m. Sundays on WBAI New York.
And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and not only we are at WBAI 99.5 in the FM dial, but also on the web at WBAI.org. And let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Steve Duncombe.
birds in trees. Send them all away. Put them in a bottle and across the sea. Speak not of your woes. Just steal yourself for holy death, crouching by the door. Writhe and sway to music's pain, searing with a sigh.
And that was Nico from her Chelsea Girl album from long, long ago, singing Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams. And we are now joined, it's a cheesy transition, I apologize for it, by Stephen Duncombe, who is another professor at NYU. Parade of NYU
town.
Professors today. Steve is the author of Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy, just published by the New Press. And welcome to Behind the News, Steve.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So you got a beef with progressives. Many of us are too earnest and too abstract and too hair-shirty, and we need a good dose of fantasy, right?
Yeah, basically. And that's partly self-critique. I mean, I've been a progressive political activist since I was 17 years old. And while I'm now, my day job is a college professor, most of my experience has been as a progressive activist and growing up within the progressive movement. My dad was an activist as well. And so it comes out of an experience, and it comes out of an experience that worries me, because I have a funny feeling that progressives are increasingly out of touch with the rest of the country, out of touch with the world in a lot of ways, in a very profound way. And that profound way, it's well-meaning. It's that we really do fundamentally believe that if we just reveal the truth and that we show people how things are, that they will flock over to our side. That's not the way the world works. It's probably not the way it's ever worked, but it's certainly in the world of fantasy construction today, not the way the world works today.
Now, I have several problems with some of your arguments, so let me lay them out. Those fantasies don't come from nowhere. They're the product of generations of experience, of indoctrination, of what we think of as common sense. Is takes a lot to get it produced and nailed into our heads. So it's not just any particular fantasy. It's a fantasy that's produced by a particular way of living and a particular power structure in the society. How do we challenge that?
Okay. Well, the first thing you do is you don't challenge it by just saying, hey, guys, open your eyes, read The New Yorker, and put down that celebrity magazine. It's not going to work. And you're absolutely right.
The New Yorker is not a celebrity magazine?
Well, actually, for a little while under Tina Brown. But what you're pointing out is, yes, look, the fantasies as we know them today, which are essentially the political fantasies of the right and the commercial fantasies of celebrity culture, advertising, and so on and so forth, have a political history and they have an economic history. And they are created in order to generate a way of seeing, a way of being that's actually going to benefit whether it's a right-wing political agenda or a massive consumer paradise. But we shouldn't forget that the left actually used to have a hammer lock on fantasy. I mean, what are dreams of democracy or socialism or anarchism or feminism except fantasies and dreams?
On this show, Susie Bright said several years ago that the workers of the world unite is actually an erotic fantasy.
Yes, well, she would say that, wouldn't
yes,
she?
Yes, she would.
And I probably agree with her, although I'm not sure Karl Marx saw
he
it
wouldn't
that way necessarily.
But that's the idea. But you also pick a couple of examples which raise questions, as they say. You open the book by recounting that famous example of the Bush administration official talking with Ron Suskind, who wrote in the New York Times Magazine that famous quote about how you people are reality-based. We're not. We want to create the reality around us. Now that everything, their reality is, or reality has bitten them in the butt, and that their power to create the world they've fantasized has proven rather limited. Do you regret that opening anymore?
No, I don't regret that opening at all, because essentially what I argue in the rest of the book is that there's a difference between sort of a fantasy which is created to cover over reality and what I call an ethical spectacle. And I think that what the left has to do is be engaged in ethical spectacles. And part of an ethical spectacle is that you don't create a fantasy to cover over reality. You actually create a spectacle in order to perform reality. What's an example? An example would be, say, the 1963 campaign to desegregate Selma, Alabama. Birmingham, in which Martin Luther King and his lieutenants go into Birmingham knowing very well Bull Connor is going to overreact and is going to perform publicly in the daylight what happens in the shadows or at nighttime for millions upon millions of African Americans in the South. This is a conscious strategy. They know it's going to happen. It is a spectacle, but it's not a spectacle which hides the reality. It's actually a spectacle that performs the reality which is unseen by most of the world.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of an act of civil disobedience, which is a classic piece of political theater.
It's an act of civil disobedience, but think about how he did it, okay? Classic civil disobedience that I've engaged in is we actually sit down at a certain moment in a place preordained by the police, have our hands locked behind us, and then marched one by one into a paddy wagon. What does that say to the world? What does that perform to the world? It performs our powerlessness. Vis-a-vis what Martin Luther King was doing, which was actually performing something which had substance, or at least got Bull Connor to perform something with substance. That's not to say it wasn't real. It was real, but it was also thought out strategically. A friend of mine, David Solnit, who you might know, who was one of the people responsible for doing a lot of the organizing which led up to the Seattle protest, once said to me is, you always have to think of a protest as a picture. And what picture do you want to present? He also said to me once, and it stuck with me as well, is that all politics is theater, just a lot of it's bad theater.
another example you pick is Las Vegas. And you mentioned the book Learning from Las Vegas by Robert Venturi, Denise Scott Brown, and Scott Eisner, which I just happened to have with me here. Now, this book
are
and Robert
to test me?
Robert Venturi's writing actually was rather significant for me in my early life. I took a modern architecture course in college with Vincent Scully, and that was one of our primary pieces of reading. And as I recall, the historical role that Learning from Las Vegas played was to challenge what had been a kind of utopian strain in modernist architecture, the Corbusier, Mies van der Rohe, and to try to put in its place some celebration of the vernacular. Now, this is not the kind of Jane Jacobs-y world of the spontaneous urban organization. It is a world created by developers. Mm-hmm. It's a book that has headlines like "The Billboard is Almost All Right," or as Venturi said, in Complexity and Contradiction, our buildings must learn to live with the cigarette machine. So, in some sense, it was a rejection of the utopian for an ironic appreciation of what is, and you could see that almost developing in the 70s to the 80s and 90s into the sensibility that produced Suck.com, yeah, which was satire of a – but it was an use of irony as a way of covering over one's surrender to the status quo. Yeah. It was not using irony as a critical tool, but it was one as kind of a narcotic drug. As Anne-Marie Cox, the former editor of Suck, once said, irony makes everything okay. And then Las Vegas, when you think about the reality of Las Vegas, and if I wanted to be really one of those hair-shirty progressives, I'd say it's an environmental abomination, a big glittering city in the middle of the desert that shouldn't be there. But it's also a city that is scientifically designed to separate working and middle-class people from their money. Mm-hmm. And yes, people love it, but in many ways it's an abomination. So what positive aspect of Las Vegas is there for us to learn from?
Okay. First of all, you're absolutely right. It is an abomination. And, you know, I do put on the hair shirt in my book and actually talk about its regressive tax structure and such. But we also have to acknowledge that it's an incredibly popular abomination. And so the question is, and you raise it, is, well, what can one rescue from that? What can one actually learn from Las Vegas? Because remember, Venturi is not saying that we have to just replicate Las Vegas. He's saying we can learn from it. It's not capitulating to Las Vegas. It's learning from it. What lessons can we draw in order to actually create a popular architecture? What lessons can
But he was never really popular. He's kind of a pointy head anyway, right?
It was a theory. But in any case, I actually think that as politicos, we actually do have to learn from Las Vegas because it's so popular. And one of the things that I like about Las Vegas is that it's phony. It's a fake. And everybody knows it's a fake. That is that what's interesting about the spectacle of Las Vegas is it presents itself as a spectacle. You go to New York, across the street is Paris. Down the block is the Grand Pyramids of Luxor. No one ever thinks they've been to New York or Paris or the pyramids. That is that they enjoy the spectacle, yet the spectacle does not pretend itself to be anything but a spectacle. Juxtapose that with the classic spectacle of George W. Bush landing on the USS Abraham Lincoln. Now, that was meant as a replacement of reality, trying to replace the fact that here's this fellow who got out of Vietnam, really had no military service in action, playing the part of a warrior prince. The hope was to erase that with this new model ideal of who George Bush was. And by the way, the war was over as well. What Las Vegas does is something very, very different. It says, we're a spectacle. You enjoy it. But we're not fooling you. That is, illusion might be a necessary part of life, but delusion doesn't need to be. What George Bush is engaged in, that level is delusion. The spectacle of Las Vegas, not the gaming tables, but the spectacle of Las Vegas is really based around illusion, which is something very different.
I had a friend, an old friend of mine, who was a psychologist who wanted to do his dissertation on self-deception, but thought that was too complicated, so gave up on the project after he found out how complicated it was. But there is a large degree of self-deception in a place like Las Vegas. It's a place people go to escape their lives for a few days, but it's precisely that. It's escapism. It's not something that is a model for utopia. It's just a way of turning off the memory circuits for a little while.
Yes and no. I would disagree with you. I don't think that there's the sort of conscious level of escape the progressives like to think that people sort of engage in when they watch celebrity news or when they go to Las Vegas. I think it's operating in a different principle, and it's both belief and disbelief, escape and not escape simultaneously. People like to engage in a fantasy, and you can create a fantasy which does not fool people, which people engage with. Same thing with professional wrestling. Professional wrestling, everybody over 12 years old knows it's a phony, but still people love to engage with it. Suspend disbelief for a few minutes, a few hours, but they're still conscious that it is fake and it is phony. Therefore, nobody's being deluded in all this, but people are enjoying it. The problem I have with too much of sort of progressive styling of either demonstrations or arguments and so on and so forth is that they actually treat fantasy and treat desire as something to be gotten away from. I actually think we have to embrace it, but do it in a different way. And I think that that's what I try to do in this book, is actually point some directions of a different way to do fantasy. It does not mean that we adopt wholesale the sort of spectacles and fantasies of commercial culture. It does not mean that what progressives need to do is make sexier advertisements, although that might help. What it really means is to try to rethink politics from the top to the bottom in a way that embraces our dreams and desires.
I should say, I'm speaking with Stephen Duncombe, who is the author of Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy, just published by the New Press. And I couldn't agree with you more on the style of progressive demonstration. There's nothing duller or more painful than listening to 3 hours of speeches by a representative of every sponsoring organization. I think that is just madness that drives away any sensible person.
Well, it is a spectacle to begin with. I mean, there's this thing we have to remind ourselves is that this is a spectacle. It's a bad spectacle. It's a spectacle that, ironically, in the name of people's power, essentially puts the audience in a passive position. In a passive role. You march where you're supposed to march. You stop where you're supposed to stop. You listen to greater people than you speak to you about what you already know. You clap at certain paces. This is a politics of spectatorship. Progressives shouldn't be reproducing a politics of spectatorship within their own demonstrations.
Returning to some of the examples you give, you also mentioned video games, and you have a little qualified celebration of Grand Theft Auto. Very much like Las Vegas, I think this is escapism. This is a world without consequences.
Yes.
So what kind of model can it be? I mean, this is something that people can, you play a video game and you can commit multiple rapes and murders and you never get arrested or shot. Yes. What do we take away from that towards a more transformative politics?
Right. First of all, you're right. It is essentially about a world without consequences, as is celebrity culture as well. And it also is apocalyptically violent. It's also a lot of fun to play. And one of the reasons it's fun to play.
And I'm not denying that violence can be fun.
Right.
So,
right.
Or fantasized violence can be fun.
But it's not just the fantasized violence. And that's what's interesting about it. It's about the playing field. And the playing field is immense in a game like Grand Theft Auto. You don't just follow, you know, step A to step B to step C. In fact, in a place like Grand Theft Auto, you can take a left instead of a right. You can never fulfill your mission, but actually tool around three cities which exist within the sort of the game space of Grand Theft Auto. And when I was playing Grand Theft Auto, which is immensely popular, with best-selling games for 2 years running, I realized that this is one of the pleasures, is the openness, the open architecture. I don't want to borrow the escapism. I don't think progressives should be borrowing escapism. We want to get people engaged. But we can get people engaged in a process which is open, which allows people to take lefts instead of rights, which isn't about block marching or professionalized politics, but instead actually engages people's desire to explore.
You talk about Reclaim the Streets, something you're heavily involved with in the 90s as an example also of a different kind of political organization. And I'm extremely sympathetic to the goals of Reclaim the Streets and opposing the privatization of public space and the commercialization of everything and wanting to introduce eros and excess into daily life. These are all admirable goals, and I would sign on that kind of agenda in a second. But it didn't really do much to change land use in the city. What lasting effects did that moment have? It was a lot of fun for the participants. Did it win over any supporters from people who were passing by, or you know, people who were trying to cross the street and found a bunch of folks dancing in the middle of it? Were they annoyed, or were they charmed? And what kind of lasting effects does something like that have?
Well, first of all, I think they were charmed much more than they would be by the usual left-wing demonstration. In fact, we would pull people off the sidewalks and into the streets, because what we do is we'd throw these massive street parties. They were fun. They were engaging. We also claimed media attention to a media which is basically bored by most other protests. And for a limited time, we confused the NYPD. They had no idea how to shut this thing down. But to look at Reclaim the Streets as just something that was about reclaiming public space is a misnomer. We actually worked within relatively straight campaigns to save the gardens and also to unionize Mexican-American green grocery workers. And when we would do that, what we do is we'd work in conjunction with a longer-range campaign. And there we actually did have real successes. We staged one of our big protests on a slow news day of this week-long cycle that was going to lead up to a mass civil disobedience. And within a week and a half, Giuliani had settled about saving community gardens. We staged these massive wrestling matches in the middle of streets in front of greengrocers. And with Super Borrow Man playing out and defeating these various evildoers in sort of high camp Mexican style wrestling. And within 2 weeks, Elliot Spitzer basically sat down with the Korean Green Grocers Association and said, you're going to have to bargain or you're going to be paying a lot of back wages. Now, was there a one-to-one correlation? Not necessarily, but we were able to bring in and politicize people that would have shunned politics otherwise, and we also were able to garner media attention with a media which is, frankly, as bored as we are with your standard left-wing demonstration.
Now, that example of the Mexican grocery workers, that, you know, there was a union involved,
yes.
a major union, Unite, with professional organizers who are there every day doing a lot of grunt work.
And wrestling, by the way. They made up the staff of the wrestlers as well.
And well, if you look at what's happened in New York City and state politics in recent years, victories have been won by the Working Families Party, yeah. which has done very, very traditional style organizing, knocking on doors and that sort of thing. What is the relation of your idea of a fantasized politics with that kind of traditional organizing and activism?
Well, I think it can work hand in hand. One of the points that I am definitely not trying to make is I do not think embracing fantasy and spectacle is a substitute for old-fashioned door-to-door, you know, stuffing envelope politics. That is the bottom line of all real good political work. What this is a way to open up that process, open it up to new people, open it up to ways of seeing that have been shunted aside by standard progressive organizing techniques and sort of standard progressive thought. But I don't see this as a substitute whatsoever. This is another tool. We need as many tools as possible if we're going to actually fight and win, and we need to be able to draw from as much as possible if we're going to be able to fight and win. And the bottom line is I'm in it to win. I'm in it because I actually want a different future, not because I want to tell myself I'm right all the time. And I think progressives get into the habit of saying, well, we're right, and that's good enough. Well, that's not good enough. And part of the things we have to learn from is, well, what are the things around us of which people seem to like, seem to be fascinated by? And is there anything within that which is recuperable?
Yeah. What is it that makes progressive politics so prone to that kind of eat your spinach dullness? Is it something, is it just bad habits that we've gotten into, or is there something that is deeply embedded in the worldview that expresses itself in that kind of dullness?
Well, I think a little bit of both, because at times progressive movement has been, like I said, on the forefront of dreams. I mean, who is remembered for I Have a Dream after all? But I also think that there is a sort of enlightenment guilt complex that progressives have, is we really do come out of an enlightenment tradition, which at one time was quite progressive, which says that there is a truth. It is revealable, and once people see the truth, the scales will fall from their eyes and the truth shall set them free. And we heartfelt, we really, really believe that. I don't believe that anymore.
So then how does one propagandize? Do you give up on telling the truth?
No, you don't give up on telling the truth. What you do is you create a propaganda of the truth. What you do, again, is you make a spectacle which reveals or performs the truth, which shows the truth. The truth is not self-evident. It has to be displayed. It has to be marketed. It has to have stories told about it. It has to be sung from the mountaintops.
I think some of what you're saying is that we need to have some utopian fantasies, some sensuous and appealing images or aspirations of what the world could be like and communicate those, and we're not doing that very well at all. One of the things I was a little frustrated about with the book is there's not enough examples of, yeah. of just how we take this principle, which much of which appeals to me, but I don't know how we, how first of all, who we are in this right. situation, and how do we inject this into circulation?
Okay, well, the we in this case is anybody who wants to read the book and apply it. And the reason I didn't put examples in, and I thought about it, I put past examples in, what groups have done in the past, what groups are doing on the ground today. But I didn't do a sort of proscriptive politics, because essential to an ethical spectacle is it's not dictated by media professors like myself. It's something that people have to figure out on the ground, and it's going to be contingent on local conditions and who's engaged in it, and it's going to bend and shape depending on who participates in it. It is not a top-down sort of media-savvy, media-expert approach. It really is an idea of a bottom-up, bubbling up of popular fantasy, and then figuring out how to visualize that, how to express it, how to perform it.
All right. Well, I think everyone should pick up the book and think about this. This is Dream, Reimagining Progressive Politics in an Age of Fantasy. The author is Stephen Duncan, we've just heard from. Stephen is also a professor teacher the history of politics and media of history and politics and media and culture at the Gallatin School at NYU. Thanks for joining us, Steve, and good luck with the book. And
I think you're supposed to say dream on now.
Dream on, man. I'll have to come up with a better set of fantasies. I think that's my mission for the coming year. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news. I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this dreamy little bit from David Bowie from long ago.